1 Kings chapter 17. We're going to be focused in verses 7 through 9 this morning, but I'll read again from the beginning of the chapter, and I'll read through to the end of verse 9. Now Elijah the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word." And the word of the Lord came to him, "Depart from here and turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. You shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there." So he went and did according to the word of the Lord. He went and lived by the brook Cherith, that is east of the Jordan. And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening. And he drank from the brook. And after a while, the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. Then the word of the Lord came to him, "Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you." All right, what we've covered so far in our study, just beginning our study in the life and ministry of Elijah the prophet, is that he has been called to be a prophet of the Lord at a very critically important time in the history of Israel. He's considered, in the New Testament perspective, to be one of the two most important prophets in all of the history of Israel. When you consider all of the great prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, he rises in significance above even all of those, even though there's no book written by him like Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, Daniel, and the others. Nevertheless, his ministry is even more important and significant than theirs. And he is second only in significance and importance biblically to Moses in terms of the Old Testament prophets. The reason why his ministry is so important is because of what was happening in Israel at the time that the Lord called him into his service. What's going on is it's a time of great declension. It's the entire nation drifting away from the Lord. It's the entire nation that has become really trapped in idolatry and has moved further and further in rebellion against the Lord and against his word and against the Lord's laws. And so Elijah's role in his ministry is to restore all of that in Israel, to call Israel back to the Lord, to create a time of great revival in which the people of God will be brought back to the Lord and brought back into a right relationship with the Lord. But before any of that can happen, and that's going to happen as we go further into the life and ministry of Elijah, before any of that happens, first the nation has to taste the judgment of the Lord, the consequence for their rebellion. Because right now, the nation's hearts are hardened toward the Lord. And before the Lord reaches that soft part of their heart, he has to first break that hard outer portion of their heart, and he breaks it through his judgment. And the judgment that the Lord brings through Elijah as he sends him to confront the wayward king of Israel, Ahab, the judgment is there's going to be no rain in the land for 3 years. Not a single drop of rain or dew on the land for 3 years. And when there's no rain, the crops will not grow. When the crops don't grow, the people will begin to starve. It's going to become a time of great famine. So the Lord speaks this judgment through Elijah. They're not empty words. He speaks the word that there's going to be no rain, and at that moment forward, the rain does not fall in Israel. And, of course, because he's in Israel, he's subject to the same physical circumstances that everyone else is subject to. So the Lord makes a special provision for the prophet, and he sends him to this one location, the brook Cherith, or the brook Cherith, as I think it's properly pronounced. And this is outside of the city This is outside of the population center. This is this small little camping location that the Lord has marked out for his servant. There's water there, not an abundance, apparently because it's a brook, not a fast-flowing river, but there's water there to drink, clean water, and there is food that's not there, but sent there miraculously, supernaturally by the Lord as he tells Elijah, go there because I've commanded the ravens to feed you there. And what we see take place, and we focused on this in last month's study, is the Lord sends a kind of an avian airlift of food supply. The ravens carrying bits of food either in their beaks or their claws, and they fly over this location and drop food for him every morning and food for him every evening. And he is miraculously supplied. Now, this is not like the Lord has sent him on a resort vacation, and he's not getting up and going to a wonderful buffet breakfast and dinner every night. The kind of food that they were dropping is probably not the finest food in the land, but it is food that provides for him and meets his need while the rest of the nation surrounding him is beginning to starve under the weight of the famine caused by the lack of rain in the land. Now that's where we left off, and again we're picking up now at the end of verse 6, as the ravens are bringing him bread and meat in the morning, bread and meat in the evening. He's drinking from the brook. Verse 7 is where we'll pick up, and I'll reread verses 7 through 9 as we move a little bit further into his story here. It says in verse 7, and after a while, the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. Then the word of the Lord came to him, arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you. All right, so we have here in the midst of this circumstances, he camped by the brook Cherith. And how did he get there? The Lord has specifically directed him with a special guidance, a word from the Lord. Go to the brook Cherith. I will feed you there. He arrives at the brook Cherith. He's been there for how long? We don't know. Whether it's a day, a month, a year, we don't know the time period that he was there at the brook. All we know, it's been a while that he's there. He's been drinking every day from the brook. He's been eating what the ravens are dropping every morning and every evening. The Lord is providing miraculously for him. He is in the place of obedience. He's exactly where he belongs on planet Earth, which, by the way, is something we shouldn't quickly move past and ignore. I want you to understand this as a principle, because this applies to all of us. There is, for every moment of our lives, a place, a specific location where we belong. There's a place where the Lord wants us. There's a place where the Lord sees more clearly than we do that this is where we belong. This is where his purpose for us during this phase of our life and service to the Lord is going to be fulfilled. And when we're in that place, we're in a place of obedience, kind of a spiritual sweet spot of the Lord's favor and the Lord's blessing. We're where we belong, doing what we should be doing, and the Lord's blessing overflows our life with his favor. That's where Elijah was. He was in the place of obedience, the sweet spot of the Lord's direction and guidance. And in that place, after a while, the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. So my question is, why, if he's where he belongs, if he's doing what he's supposed to be doing, why would the brook dry up? And the thing that we normally consider, we're putting ourselves, and rightly so, we're putting ourselves in Elijah's situation. We're considering this story from the perspective of our own life circumstances. There are times when we're in situations that we shouldn't be in, places we shouldn't be, life circumstances that we got ourselves into, getting ahead of the Lord or disregarding the Lord and His word and His principles, where we make decisions and we wind up in a circumstance that we never should have been in. And we find ourselves in that circumstance and we shouldn't be, but we get surprised, we get amazed when the circumstances surrounding us start to dry up. You know, when the brook dries up and it's your only water source, that's a signal that things are about to get serious. When this is the only water that you can drink to sustain your life, and all of a sudden the water is drying up right in front of your eyes, that's when things get serious. And here Elijah is in this circumstance, and I've been in similar kinds of circumstances many times, but, and you have as well, but when we're in that situation because we shouldn't have been there, and the brook dries up, the circumstances around us are starting to dry up and shrivel, and we're suddenly amazed and surprised that things aren't going as well as they ordinarily go, and things aren't as pleasant and as comfortable as they have always been. The point of that situation is the Lord is using the drying up of the brook to get our heart's attention, to make us come to an awareness of the consequences of our disregard for Him or our disobedience toward Him, toward His word, toward His principles. To shock us by the circumstance into, maybe I shouldn't have made this decision, to a point where we would repent and return to the right ways of the Lord and to the circumstance that He originally wanted us to be in rather than the one that we find ourselves in. But that's not what's going on with Elijah here. He's in a place of obedience. He's exactly where he should be, and yet the brook dries up. This is where the Lord said, go here, I'll miraculously provide for you. Now I'm thinking in terms of, remember I made a connection last month that Elijah is functioning in this moment in history kind of like a second Moses. And this circumstance of his is like a second time of Israel in the wilderness. It's paralleling the story of Israel's journey from Egypt to the promised land as they pass through this wilderness testing of their faith. And how did the Lord provide for the children of Israel to drink fresh water while they were in the wilderness? He provided a supernatural rock and brought forth water from that rock and provided more than enough water for the entire, not just for Moses, but for the entire nation to drink in the midst of a desert. The point being is that if you're where you belong, the Lord is fully capable of making provision for you where you are supposed to be in order to fulfill His purpose and to serve Him the way He calls you to do so. So here he is at the brook Cherith. The Lord is sending the ravens still every morning and every evening. They're still dropping the food on him, but he's watching day by day. And the implication is it didn't just dry up suddenly overnight. There's a progression of the brook drying up. The Lord was well capable of, just like doing a miracle through the ravens, doing an additional miracle to provide for him water in the brook or through some other means. Yet, in this circumstance, the brook is drying up, and my question is, why would it? It's not an evidence of the Lord's favor diminishing in Elijah's life. And this is where it really requires of us, when we find ourselves in a similar kind of situation, to exercise discernment. Elijah had to discern whether the drying up of the brook was because he was sinning or because the Lord was using the circumstance of the drying brook in order to do something additional with him and for him and through him that he didn't do by speaking a clear and direct word to him. So what's the point of the drying brook? From what we can tell in the story, and there's no hint here that Elijah has committed any sin while he's camped there by the brook Cherith. There's no hint that he's doing wrong or that he has in his heart crossed the line into some sin or some rebellion. He's still remaining in obedience. So if the Lord is not judging him for his sin by causing the brook to dry up, there must be another reason or another purpose for the brook doing so. Why would he do so? Well, there's a couple of things going on here, I think. One is, as the brook is drying up, his trust and faith in the Lord's previous direction is being tested. He's watching day by day. The food's still dropping on his head, which is evidence of the Lord's continued favor. Because if it was completely this, that I'm in the wrong place, I don't belong here, I shouldn't be in this situation, the ravens wouldn't be dropping the food on his head. The ravens are dropping the food on a daily basis because the Lord has directed them to do so. It's an evidence of the Lord's blessing and favor. Yet he's watching the brook dry up day by day. And so the Lord is continuing to favor him, yet I'm in his shoes asking this question, Lord, why is the brook drying up? What are you trying to speak to me in this circumstance? But I'm doing so from a heart of faith and trust rather than from a heart of, Lord, how dare you cause the brook to dry up because you directed me here? There's no sense or no hint of any kind of accusatory reaction on Elijah's part toward the Lord as the brook is drying up. He's simply silent during the whole process. But his silence here, I think, can be easily or rightly interpreted as his heart remains firm and steadfast in trust in the Lord, in spite of the progression of the brook drying up a little bit more each day. So why would the Lord do this? He's testing his faith. And then the second thing is, the Lord is using the drying up of the brook as a circumstantial preparation for a new direction that he is about to give to Elijah. This phase of Elijah's life is 3 years long. The phase between him proclaiming the judgment of no rain in the land, and we'll see in his story as we get to it eventually, the Lord is going to release that judgment and he's going to cause rain to fall once again on Israel, but only after the completion of this 3 year appointed time of the Lord's judgment. So this 3 year period, it identifies a specific phase in Elijah's ministry. But that phase is broken up into two segments. It's not one long extended camp session at the location of the brook Kereth. He's there for a while, and then the Lord is going to, as we see here at the end of this section we read this morning, the Lord is about to redirect him to go to the city of Zarephath, and there he's going to remain for the remainder of this 3 year time period. But before the Lord speaks to him, get up from Kereth and move to Zarephath, before he gives him a clear direction, he begins to prepare his heart for this change by causing the brook to dry up. And if he's discerning, he'll recognize the drying up of the brook as the Lord's preparation for things are about to change. And I see the Lord's mercy in that, the Lord's grace in that, that the Lord doesn't just, boom, give him a brand new direction that's going to be a shock to his system, but day by day, he's preparing his heart for things are in the process of being about to change in his life, and the entire circumstance of his life is about to change as he moves from one location to the second. Now, there's an additional statement that's added here in the text in verse 7. After a while, the brook dried up. That's the circumstance. And then the second part of verse 7 is what we would call an explanatory note. But it's not added by Elijah himself. It's added by the author of the book of 1 Kings. After a while, the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. The explanatory note is for our benefit, to help us to understand, why is the brook drying up? The brook's drying up because the Lord's judgment is upon the entire land. That entire region is now under the judgment of the Lord. There is no rain falling, and whatever water source fed the brook Cherith up until now, that water source is diminishing, and so the brook Cherith is slowly drying up, just like the entire land is drying up. Now, what's important for us to catch is that the Lord does not speak that word of explanation to Elijah. He's in that circumstance, but you and I are looking from a higher level perspective because we have the benefit of seeing this through the Lord's perspective as the writer is later describing the events as they're unfolding and adding little notes of explanation so that we get the point of what's going on. Now, it's not that Elijah is unaware that there's a judgment upon the land. He's the one that proclaimed it. But the Lord never said to him, when he sent him to the brook, he never said, "You'll be there for a while. I'll be sending the ravens day by day. And this brook is going to be your only water source. But I'm letting you know in advance, there's going to come a point because of the judgment upon the whole land that your water source is going to begin to dry up. But don't worry, I've got you covered." The Lord never gives him that full explanation. He simply sends him there, tells him he'll provide for him there, and allows him to experience the circumstance without the added note of explanation. And what I take from that is, for myself and what I think you need to understand for your own walk with the Lord, is that the Lord will at times give you a direction. He'll indicate to you what he wants you to be focused on, where he wants you to be, what he wants you to be doing during this phase of your life. But he will not always give you a full explanation of the meaning behind all of the circumstances that you will encounter while you're obeying him. And it's not that the Lord intentionally keeps you in the dark just to, you know, be jerking you around. But the Lord does keep Elijah somewhat in the dark about his circumstance for a reason. And again, this is the testing of his faith concept that's being played out in his real life circumstances. But it's circumstances as basic to his life as drinking water. I mean, you know how it is for us. We have such overabundance of provision of drinking water. You can turn on your tap, unless you live in Flint, Michigan. You can turn on your tap and you can drink clean water, relatively clean water anytime you want. I have water filtered through my refrigerator that's even doubly filtered from the tap water. And then I have pitchers that I pour water into that triply filter the water. And then if ever I want, I can just pick up a bottle of bottled clean water anytime I want to drink it. I have multitudes of options for clean drinking water. Elijah had one. It's drying up, and the Lord doesn't explain to him, never speaks a word to him about this is going to happen. It's just happening, and his heart is having to deal with the reality of, I don't have as much drinking water as I used to have, and I can see that if this process of the brook drying up continues, there's going to come a point in the very near future where I won't have any water to drink. And he's left to just deal with that reality in his heart's relationship with the Lord. But again, no hint of him complaining, no hint of him questioning the Lord in an unhealthy heart perspective. He's simply enduring his circumstance, and the indication is, in terms of how the story is told, his heart's in a good and healthy place of trust and faith in the Lord. But the Lord's not explaining, and I'll just say it this way, the Lord is never obligated to explain his actions to us because we're his servants. It is true that we're his sons as well. We are members of his family, and we have all of the confidence that the Lord has communicated to us that we should have as sons in his family, that he cares for us, he loves us, he provides for us, but he also calls us to serve him in our assignment in his kingdom. And in our service, the focus is more on us as his servants than it is on us as his sons. And in this circumstance, Elijah is there at the brook as the servant of the Lord. And the issue is, the Lord is never as master of the house, as Lord of the kingdom. He's never obligated to offer any explanation to his servants as to why he's doing what he's doing, the timing of what he's doing, how long it's going to last, how long it's going to continue, and when and how he's going to provide for us a way out. And we're called in our service, when we find ourselves in similar circumstances, to simply do what Elijah did, quietly trust the Lord. He's the same one who's providing the raven food for us on a daily basis. Therefore, even if the brook is drying up in front of me, my heart should not be troubled. I should not fear. I should not worry. I'm confident that the Lord is doing something, even if I don't see and understand all the details. He's doing something purposefully in this circumstance. I need to trust in him. Now, the second principle I think we should mention here is that when it says there was no rain in the land, the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. The no rain in the land is the judgment upon the entire region. And the question is, when the Lord judges a circumstance on earth, whether it is a person, whether it is a family, whether it is a city, whether it is, in this case, an entire nation and the region surrounding that nation, because this brook was outside of the immediate circumstances of the nation. It's in the surrounding area. But this entire area is being affected by the judgment upon this nation. The question is, will those who are true believers be exempt from the consequences of the judgment that the nation is called to endure in order to get the nation's attention? We've talked in recent times about the principle of God being a judge of the nations, and God using judgment to gain the attention of hard and rebellious hearts. And when the Lord brings judgment upon the nation, for instance, if the Lord were to judge, and I think we can all agree, this nation in which we live certainly needs a fresh experience of the Lord's judgment. The nation is filled with hard and wayward hearts. And when a heart reaches that level of hardness toward the Lord, the only thing that will gain that heart's attention is a fresh experience of the Lord's judgment. But when the Lord does, and it's inevitable that he will, judge this nation once again, as he has in times past, when that happens, will all of the true believers within the boundaries of this nation be automatically exempt from the consequences of the Lord changing the favorable circumstances that the nation had previously enjoyed? Meaning, will it be a situation where everyone who doesn't know the Lord is suffering under judgment, but all of us who are true believers get to go scot-free without any experience of that consequence that's upon the nation? The answer is, no, it doesn't work that way. That's not the general pattern that the Lord follows. There are a few exceptions to this principle, and we see this, for instance, played out in the circumstance of how the Lord brought the 10-plague judgment upon the nation of Egypt, and how the Lord preserved, under a different set of circumstances, his people, Israel, during that time period. That's a focus of a different study, and there are reasons why the Lord made an exception and made an exemption for his people Israel while he was judging Egypt. But in this circumstance, Elijah, even though he has been receiving food and water while the rest of the nation is suffering under this judgment, he himself is going to experience the diminishing of his own water supply while the nation around him is experiencing the same thing. And in that regard, I think Elijah is going to, in a firsthand way, be identifying in a good and healthy way with what the nation is having to experience. He's not being completely exempted from the judgment upon the covenant nation because Elijah is part of that covenant nation. Now, the principle here is described for us, and if you want, you can turn with me to this passage in the New Testament. It's in Romans chapter 5 that this principle is identified, and it's related to the consequence and judgment that comes because of sin. But Paul here in Romans 5 is using the very first sin in human history to describe this principle of how the Lord deals with the world and with the population of the world. I'll read from Romans 5, and this is part of a much longer explanation of this principle. I don't have time to do an in-depth study of the verses surrounding it, but let's just focus on the key verse, Romans 5:14. He's talking about Adam, and he's talking about the sin as a consequence of that sin that Adam committed, producing the judgment of the Lord that fell upon the human race as a result of Adam's sin. Verse 14, yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sinning was not like the transgression of Adam, who is a type of the one who was to come. Now this phrase, even over those whose sinning was not like the transgression of Adam, this is not describing that those who followed Adam did not sin like Adam sinned. It's describing that Adam committed a sin, and in his sin, there was a consequence that was set in motion in human history. And that consequence was the Lord's judgment upon all of the descendants of Adam. And even if they didn't commit the identical sin that Adam himself committed, they all experienced consequence as a result of the sin that he committed. Now that principle is played out even in the circumstances of Elijah. There is a sin that Israel as a covenant nation is committing at this time in history. It's the sin of idolatry, the sin of rebellion and disregard for the laws of the Lord. Elijah himself is not committing idolatry. He himself is not in rebellion. He is not disobeying the Lord. He is not disregarding his laws, yet he's experiencing some of the consequences that are upon the entire nation because of the Lord's well-deserved judgment upon that nation. All right, let's head back to 1 Kings 17. So we find the circumstance. He's there at the brook Cherith. The brook dries up because there's no rain in the land. Verse 8, then the word of the Lord came to him. And I like the way the Lord introduces this new expression of clear and special communication to Elijah. It's not the first time the Lord's spoken to him. We see back in verse 2 of chapter 17, and the word of the Lord came to him. The Lord has spoken to him in a similar way and given him special guidance before, but here, this special guidance comes at the exact moment that Elijah most needs to hear a clear word from the Lord. And that is, after a while, the brook dried up. So there's process of the brook drying up over time has been happening. But at the end of verse 7, where do we find ourselves in regards to the brook? We're in Elijah's shoes. We're there at our camping spot. We've been there for a while. We've seen the water diminishing day by day. But now one day he wakes up, and what is the circumstance that day? It's dry. The brook Cherith is dried up. The water is gone. What am I going to drink that day? Then the word of the Lord came to him. I just love how the Lord picks the exact perfect moment to speak to him. And what he speaks to him is not just, hey, how's the weather down there today, Elijah? He speaks to him a word of direction. He basically tells him, it's time to move. Arise, get up from your location, break camp, and move to a new spot. A new spot that's not just arbitrary. Don't just pick a new spot. The Lord redirects him to a very specific new location. But he does so at the exact right moment. Now, what would have happened had Elijah, and this is supposition because this never happened, but I think we're allowed to ask these kind of questions in this circumstance of the Lord's special guidance. What would have happened if 3 days before this, as Elijah is noticing the brook is drying up, there's less and less water each day as he wakes up and goes to the water source for his drink for the day. What would have happened if he sees the brook drying up and says to himself, you know, the Lord has been very gracious to provide for me here. He's having these ravens fly over every morning and every evening. They're dropping the food that I need. There's been water for me to drink. And the ravens are still dropping the food, but the water is drying up. It's not going to last much longer if this progression continues. And I haven't heard a peep from the Lord. So it must be time for me to move. I need to get up and I need to find some water. What would have happened if he had broken camp and left 3 days prior to then the word of the Lord came to him? What would he have, out of all the locations on planet Earth that were available for him to go instead of the brook Cherith, would he have chosen to go to Zarephath? And the answer is, as we'll see in a moment, it's probably the last place on earth he would have chosen to go. He would not have gone to Zarephath. He would have gone somewhere else, probably someplace familiar to him. Maybe he would have gone back toward Israel in order to see if there was some water to drink there. But the point is, had he made a decision to move prematurely from the place of the Lord's specific and clear special guidance that brought him there, had he left there before he should have left there, the likelihood is he would have missed the second layer or the second expression of the Lord's special guidance for him. We might not have the second word from the Lord because he would have already been moving in the wrong direction. So Elijah stays. He trusts the Lord. He stays right up till the day that the brook finally and fully dries up. And even then, he doesn't leave until then the word of the Lord came to him saying, arise and go to Zarephath. And every indication is he stayed as long as he should. He trusted the Lord, waited patiently for him, endured the drying up of the brook, and left at exactly the right moment. And the right moment was when the Lord released him from the previous direction. The previous direction was, looking back up again, verse 2, and the word of the Lord came to him, depart from here and turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. You shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there. So he went and did according to the word of the Lord. The point is that the previous word of the Lord placed him under spiritual obligation. Had he left 3 days before, he would have been in the same kind of disobedience and rebellion that the rest of the nation was suffering under. Because the word of the Lord gave him specific direction to go to this one spot, and the clear implication of the word from the Lord was, go there, stay there, don't leave there. And when you receive a direction from the Lord, this is where you belong. You're meant to stay in that location until the Lord speaks just as clearly to you a second time as he did the first. So then the word of the Lord came to him, this new communication from the Lord, perfect timing, and yet, even though this is clearly the Lord speaking and he is a prophet of God and he knows it's the Lord, this is not an issue of discernment like, you know, how as believers in the new covenant, we have to, when we talk in terms of the Lord leading us or the Lord guiding us or the Lord speaking to us, We use that terminology sometimes way too loosely, and we you know, from a biblical perspective, we really need to tighten that kind of communication up and those concepts up. But here, this is an audible voice. The word of the Lord coming to Elijah was not something for him to discern. He knew this was the Lord and the Lord was speaking to him. Nevertheless, what the Lord said to him had to be a tremendous test of faith for him. The Lord said to him, "Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there." Dwell there indicates go there, settle down there, live there. And what's going to unfold, as we see in the next phase of the story, he's going to be there for the duration of this three-year time period of the Lord's judgment until the time comes for the Lord to lift the judgment of no rain and dew upon the land. So out of all the locations on planet Earth, why did the Lord choose this place? And it is specific. It is very, the Lord has a very clear intent and purpose, plan and purpose in it. And Elijah doesn't know the reasons at this point. I mean, he may have his own thoughts and ideas. I'm sure he did, as we'll see in just a moment. But this is a very special and purposeful direction for the Lord. Let's look back one chapter. Turn with me back to chapter 16. We read this in our first study in Elijah's life, in the introductory study that we did. But it would be easy to forget this bit of information, but we need to remember it at this point in the story. We're going to read from verse 29 of chapter 16. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, remember, is the king at the time of Elijah's ministry. He's the king that Elijah has confronted. He's the king that he's proclaimed the judgment of the Lord to. Ahab the son of Omri began to reign over Israel, and Ahab the son of Omri reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. And Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him, meaning all the kings, even the most wicked ones that had preceded him. Verse 31, and as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat. Jeroboam, remember, was the first king of the northern tribes, the 10 tribes that the Lord split off as judgment during the time following the reign of Solomon. As if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. And those were sins of idolatry, sins of Baalism, the worship of false gods. He took for his wife, this is Ahab did, he took for his wife Jezebel. And we're going to spend a lot of time focused on the interaction between Elijah and this queen of Israel, Jezebel, the wife of Ahab, because she is as wicked as Ahab is. He took for his wife Jezebel, the son of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. Now, let's look back at verse 9 in chapter 17. Arise and go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon. Sidon is the kingdom of the Sidonians. So where does the Lord, after he has taken Elijah out of the picture and have him camp for a while out in the wilderness by the brook Cherith, where does he now send him for the second phase of the duration of the three-year judgment upon Israel? He sends him out of Israel entirely. He sends him to a neighboring kingdom, and there were neighboring kingdoms surrounding Israel, but out of all the neighboring kingdoms he could have sent him to, which one does he send him to? The kingdom of the Sidonians, the kingdom from which Jezebel, the queen that Ahab chose to intermarry with, who was not the entire cause of the sins that Ahab led Israel into, but she is a driving evil influence behind the scenes. In other words, she is largely responsible for the influence, and we're going to see this play out further, and there's going to be more detailed background given to us as we dig deeper into Elijah's story. But she's a driving force behind the Baalism that is now infesting the worship of Israel. So much so that her own father, who is the king of the Sidonians, is named Ethbaal, meaning he is a servant of Baal, this false god who is a rival, spiritually, religiously speaking, to Yahweh, the one true God of Israel. So he sends Elijah, gives him a direction where you're going, and he well knows, Elijah well knows exactly who Jezebel is. He knows where she came from. He knows exactly what the reputation of the Sidonians is. And it's like the Lord is saying to him, okay, this is my special guidance for you, Elijah. This is my special provision for you. You are now going from the frying pan into the fire. He's taking him to a worse place. The worst place on planet Earth, so to speak. Not physically. It's actually by the coast. It's actually by the coast of the Mediterranean. And I don't know if any of you have traveled into that location of the Earth. I haven't, but I've seen pictures. I've seen TV shows. You know, the coast of the Mediterranean, whichever location you pick, it's beautiful. It's nice. It's like resort living kind of circumstance. But it's the worst place on planet Earth at this point in time, not because of its physical lack, but because of its spiritual wickedness. It's a hotbed of idolatry. It's like if you were to trace the river of idolatry, which has reached as far as Israel and is now poisoning the water of Israel, so to speak, spiritually, if you were to trace that river back to its source, it's flowing out of Sidon at this particular point in history. Why would the Lord ever lead a true prophet of the Lord from a place that's infected by idolatry back to the very source of where that infection began? Because this is not this service that Elijah is living out for the Lord and his kingdom. It's not for Elijah's benefit. His service is not about, I want to take you to the most comfortable spot. I want to take you to the safest and securest spot on the face of planet Earth. Because he's serving the Lord, and the Lord's service is all about the confrontation between a kingdom of darkness and a kingdom of light, a kingdom of deceit and a kingdom of truth. And he represents the kingdom of light and the kingdom of truth. And so the Lord takes him to the very hotbed and source of where things are worse in order for him to fulfill the next phase of his ministry and his service to the Lord. No, Elijah may not understand all the details of that, but he does understand this. That's where Baalism starts. And that's where the Baalism that's infecting Israel has come from. And he knows that that's where the Lord is taking him. That represents an additional test of faith to Elijah's heart. Can he trust the Lord to take him into the very heart of Baal country? And not just to visit there on a short missionary trip, like I've gone to India several times, as you know, representing the word of the Lord to a culture and a nation that it's for the most part steeped in spiritual darkness. I've gone to Kenya now a couple of times and done a similar kind of thing, teaching pastors in both locations, and been blessed by the Lord to do so. But I'm not complaining about this. For me, it's been a blessing that the Lord has taken me there for 10 days at a time, or in the context of the Kenya ministry, 3 weeks at a time. And at the end of those 10 days or 3 weeks, I go to the airport and I get on to a nice comfortable plane and I fly home. And I'm back in the comforts of home. This is what he says to Elijah. Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. You're going to call it home. And he doesn't say to him, dwell there for a day, a week, a month. Don't worry, it's just going to be for a short period of time, and then I'm bringing you back home where things are familiar and comfortable to you. He just tells him, dwell there. And as far as Elijah knows, when he hears this word, because the Lord doesn't give him any additional information, as far as he knows, he's going to be dwelling there for how long? The rest of his life. As far as he knows. When the Lord gives a word, you are supposed to go to this location and dwell there. And he doesn't add any extra information on top of that. You might as well be of the mindset, if I'm living there for the rest of my life, I'm good with that because I know the Lord sent me there. And I'm supposed to dwell there. And I'm not looking for a way out of there because that's where the Lord has directed me. Until the Lord gives him additional guidance. And the Lord will, as we'll see in the next phase, at the end of this, this phase here in Zarephath, the Lord is going to speak to him a third time and direct him to go back to Israel and back to Ahab and a new confrontation with Ahab. And he's going to finish the time of judgment and he's going to call the nation to revival and to a return to the Lord. But at this moment, the Lord isn't giving him all of that future guidance. At this moment, the only guidance he's given is go there and dwell there. Go to the heart of where idolatry is infecting the earth. Settle there, find a location there. And he gives him some specific information to say, I've prepared a specific household for you there. He tells him, as we see in verse 9, behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you. Now, there's some additional details that are in this verse that I want to bring out as well. One is the name of the location where he sent him. Zarephath is an important city in the Sidonian kingdom, but it's not the capital city. It's not the capital of the Sidonians. It is, in a sense, like the second most important city for the Sidonians. So why not send him to the capital city where the king of the Sidonians, Ethbaal, dwells? Because there's a widow, in this one location that he is supposed to minister to. But the name of the city is interesting to me, and sometimes we can read too much into this kind of information, but it's also possible for us to read too little from it. The name Zarephath, the city, means literally refinery or a place of smelting. It was where the Sidonian kingdom had their metal works to make the metal that they used to build and the metal that they used for their implements of war. But as we understand from a spiritual perspective, there are no accidents in how the Lord directs our lives and guides our steps. And there is meaning that we're meant to derive from where the Lord guides us and where the location of our service is. In this case, he leads Elijah in this next phase of the testing of his own character and faith and trust and obedience. He leads him to a place known as refinery. And the principle found throughout God's word is that when we're obeying the Lord, doing what we're supposed to be doing, fulfilling our assignment to the Lord, trusting in him, obeying him, we are in a process constantly, daily, whether we're consciously aware of it or not, whether it's going on behind the scenes or whether it's uppermost in our perspective, but we're in a process of being refined. And the Lord uses this imagery over and over again in Scripture to describe the process of what we now call in the New Testament sanctification. Sanctification is the great second phase of our walk with the Lord. The first phase is salvation. And nothing further happens between us and the Lord until we are first truly saved by him. But once we are saved, the shift of the Lord's purpose for us shifts from getting us saved to sanctifying us. And sanctifying means the process of inner change and transformation that the Lord is after. Salvation does not complete the work of the Lord in our lives. It simply begins the work of the Lord in our lives. Sanctification is the ongoing process of deeper change of our character, the reformation of the kind of person we are after the Lord rescues us from the consequences of our sins and our disobediences. And that is described using powerful imagery throughout God's word as a refining process. The refining process that has to do or relates to our sanctification is where the Lord describes us as a chunk of raw material, ore that's mined from the earth, but that he's after a specific element in this chunk of mixed elements that's been carved out of the earth. And in order to get the pure, and usually it's referred to as the gold that's in that chunk that he's after, what he does is what? He takes that chunk of ore that's mixed, and what does he do with that chunk in order to refine it? He puts it in a pot, and he superheats a fire under that pot until that entire chunk is reduced to liquid. And all of the impurities that are in that chunk rise to the surface because they're lighter in weight than the pure gold, which is a heavier element. That gold sinks to the bottom of that pot, and the impurities, the dross, rise to the top of the pot, and the refiner takes an implement and scrapes all of the scum. And it's also, and that's where we get the concept of scum, the scum off the surface of that superheated liquid pot of material. And the scum is just wasted. It's just to be thrown away. And it's the pure gold that's settled at the bottom of the pot that the refiner is after. And the Lord describes that he takes us repeatedly through this process of superheating our life by heating the circumstances of our life so that he can bring out a more refined gold of true faith and trust and obedience to him. And that's exactly where the Lord takes Elijah for the next phase. You're going from the frying pan of the brook Cherith into the refiner's fire of the city of Zarephath. Now, there's one other element here that I don't want us to miss. Turn in the minor prophets to everybody's favorite minor prophet, Obadiah, if you can find it. It's a very small book, one single chapter. Obadiah is right after Amos and right before Jonah. We'll pick up just a single verse from the prophecy of Obadiah. It gives us an added explanatory note of why the Lord would have sent him to Zarephath. Obadiah 1, I'll read from 19, I guess, just to get kind of the flow of the text, 19 and 20. Those of the Negeb, Negeb here is desert area, those of the Negeb shall possess Mount Esau, those of the Shephelah shall possess the land of the Philistines, they shall possess the land of Ephraim and the land of Samaria, and Benjamin shall possess Gilead. The exiles of this host of the people of Israel shall possess the land of the Canaanites as far as Zarephath. And the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Sepharad shall possess the cities of the Negev. So this is a prophecy through a small minor prophet, Obadiah. And it's a prophecy of the completion of a purpose of the Lord that was set in motion in ancient history of Israel, but it had been, for the most part, lost in the perspective of the people of Israel in the intervening years. And that was this. When the Lord first brought the children of Israel out of Egypt under the leadership of Moses, he brought them through this wilderness journey. He brought them through the wilderness journey to the very cusp or edge of the promised land there at the River Jordan. And Moses dies there in the wilderness, and the leadership of the people is passed on by the Lord's direction to Joshua. Joshua leads them across the River Jordan into the Promised Land, and he's given very specific instructions, and that is he is to lead the people in a conquest of what territory? All of the land of the Canaanites. That land, which is at that moment in history possessed by the Canaanites, defines the boundaries of the entire territory that was meant to be what we call the Promised Land. This was the location on earth that God designated at that time of history as representing the boundaries of the earthly expression of his kingdom through his chosen covenant holy nation of Israel at that time in history. What we see in the Obadiah prophecy is a description that territory that should have been conquered wasn't conquered, but the Lord was speaking that it will eventually be possessed, and the land of the Canaanites stretching as far as Zarephath will be possessed by the covenant people of Israel at some future date. Now, the point of that is this. Out of all the locations on planet Earth that the Lord would send Elijah, he sends him to Zarephath, which is not just the current hotbed and source of idolatry. It also happens, and it's certainly not coincidental or accidental, it just happens to define the outermost boundary in that direction of the boundaries of the originally designated Promised Land. But it was currently occupied and dominated by idolaters. It should have been a location at this point in history, because we're many generations following the leadership of Joshua in the conquest of the Promised Land. It should have been a place where the name of the Lord was boldly proclaimed and representing that name and the laws of the Lord to all of the surrounding nations. Instead, it remains this stronghold of idolatry and rebellion against the Lord. And so where does the Lord send his prophet? The prophet, in a sense, if we're talking about the conflict of kingdoms, the prophet is representing special forces of the Lord. One single special forces operative, a true prophet of the Lord, and he sends him to the location that had not been conquered, because the children of Israel had failed to fulfill their obedience to the Lord, and the Lord is sending him there. And of course, he's called to dwell there, and he's commanded to go find a specific widow there, and we'll save for our study next time. Why that one widow? What possible purpose could the Lord have? Because we're talking about a long location away from where he's located. And he's going to, before he gets from where he's at the Brook Kereth to where he is going to be dwelling at a widow's house in the city of Zarephath, he's going to be passing many widows of Israel on the way there. And he's going to be settling in the home of a widow of the Sidonians. And the Lord has a very special purpose in that. But we'll save that for the beginning of our study next month. All right, God bless you, men, and we'll look forward to seeing you next month, Lord willing, and we'll continue with our study through the life and ministry of Elijah.